Businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, community radio for the Pacific Northwest. Stay tuned at midnight for Joe Woods and the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Right now, the following program may contain language and situations not suitable for young audiences. But of course, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
You are entering a zone of sound and imagery. A landscape of frequency. A vocabulary of modulation. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Good evening and welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Tonight, we're going to do a special Gonzo presentation in honor of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, who passed away recently. We're going to present The Great Shark Hunt. Joining me this evening is Woody Creek.
Yeah, the Glenn Levitt's kicking in.
Oh, dude. The Great Shark Hunt originally appeared in Playboy magazine, the highest-paying literary magazine in the country, in 1974, and was reprinted by Popular Press in the book Strange Tales of Strange Days, Gonzo Papers, number one, The Great Shark Hunt.
Strange Tales from a Strange Time.
Strange Tales from a Strange Time. Some people consider it his last great collection of work, but he
they
does come out with
much.
Yeah, they give him two or three months of stuff.
Yeah.
So, in honor of Dr. Thompson, we present Woody Creek reading The Great Shark Hunt.
Hunt. 4:30 in Cozumel now. Dawn is coming up on these gentle white beaches, looking west at the Yucatan Channel. 30 yards from my patio here at Cabañas del Caribe, the surf is rolling up very softly on the beach out there in the darkness beyond the palm trees. Many vicious mosquitoes and sand fleas out here tonight. There are 60 units in this rambling beachfront hotel, but my room, number 129, is the only one full of light and music and movement. I have both my doors and all four windows propped open, a huge bright magnet for every bug on the island. But I am not being bitten. Every inch of my body, from the soles of my bleeding bandaged feet to the top of my sun-scorched head, is covered with 612 insect repellent, a cheap foul-smelling oil with no redeeming social or aesthetic characteristics except that it works. These goddamn bugs are all around, settling on the notebook, my wrist, my arms, circling the rim of my tall glass of Bacardi Añejo and ice. But no bites. It has taken about 6 days to solve this hellish bug problem, which is excellent news on the one level, but as always, the solution to one problem just peels back another layer and exposes some new and more sensitive area. At this stage of the gig, things like mosquitoes and sand fleas are the least of our worries, because in about 2 hours and 22 minutes, I have to get out of this hotel without paying an unnaturally massive bill, drive about 3 miles down the coast in a rented VW Safari that can't be paid for either, and which may not even make it into town due to serious mechanical problems, and then get my technical advisor, Yale Blore, out of the Maison San Miguel without paying his bill either, then drive us both out to the airport in that goddamn junk safari to catch the 750 Aeromexico flight to Merida and Monterey, where we'll change planes for San Antonio and Denver. So we are looking at a very heavy day, 2,000 miles between here and home, no cash at all, 10 brutally expensive days in 3 hotels on the Stryker Aluminum Yachts credit tab, which just got jerked out from under us when the local PR team decided we were acting too weird to be what we claimed to be. So now we are down to about $44 extra between us, with my bill at the Cabañas hovering around $650, and Bloor's at the San Miguel not much less, plus 11 days for that wretched car from the local Avis dealer, who already hit me for $40 cash for a broken windshield. God only knows how much he'll demand when he sees what condition the car's in now. Plus about $400 worth of black coral that we ordered up from Chino. Doubled thumbed fist, coke spoons, shark's teeth, etc., and that $120 18-karat gold chain at the market. Also Sandy's black coral necklace. We will need all available cash for the black coral deal, so things like hotel bills and car rentals will just have to be put off and paid by check, if anybody will take one. Or charge to Stryker aluminum yachts, which got me into this goddamn twisted scene in the first place. The Stryker people are no longer with us. Extreme out front hostility. Bruce, Joyce, even the bogus lecher Eduardo. How did we blow the image?
Dear Mr. Thompson, here's some background information on the Cozumel Cruise and International Fishing Tournament. Regarding the cruise schedule, about 14 strikers will leave Fort Lauderdale on April 23rd, arriving in Key West that night, leaving Key West midday on the 25th to assure skirting the Cuban coast in the daytime, and arriving in Cozumel mid-afternoon on the 27th or 28th. In addition to the proven sail fishing, there will be a marlin-only day on Saturday, May 6th, in the initial attempt on any volume basis to determine how good the blue marlin fishing is. Each night during the tournament, there are cocktail parties with over 250 people attending, mariachi and island music, etc. We are happy you can make the trip. Flights leave Miami daily for Cozumel at 2:45 p.m. You will need a Mexican tourist card, which you can pick up at the Mexican Tourism Department, 100 Biscayne Boulevard, room 612, Miami. There are no shots required. Sincerely, Terrence J. Byrne, Public Relations Representative, Stryker Aluminum Yachts, Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Yeah. Indeed, no shots. Just a tourist card, plenty of copper tone, a new pair of topsiders, and a fine gringo smile for the customs officers. The letter called up visions of a heavy sport on the high seas, mano a mano with giant sailfish and world record marlin, reeling the bastards in, fighting off sharks with big gaffs, strapped into a soft white naugahyde fighting chair in the cockpit of a big power cruiser. Then back to the harbor at dusk for a brace of gin and tonics, tall drinks in the sunset, lounging around in cool deck chairs while the crew chops up bait and a strolling mariachi band roams on the pier, wailing mournful Olmec love songs. Ah, yes, I was definitely ready for it. 16 months of straight politics had left me reeling around on the brink of a nervous breakdown. I needed a change, something totally different from my normal line of work. Covering politics is a vicious, health-ripping ordeal that often requires 8 or 9 shots at once, twice or 3 times a week in the peak season. So this unexpected assignment to cover a deep-sea fishing tournament off the Yucatan coast of Mexico was a welcome relief from the horrors of the campaign trail in 1972. Right. Things would be different now. Hot sun, salt air, early to bed, early to rise. This one had all the signs of a high-style bag job. Fly off to the Caribbean as a guest of the idle rich, fly around on their boats for a week or so, then crank out a left-handed story to cover expenses and pay for a new motorcycle back in the Rockies. The story itself was a bit on the hazy side, but the editor at Playboy said not to worry. Almost everybody unfortunate enough to have any dealings with me since the campaign ended seemed convinced that I was in serious need of a vacation. A cooling out period, chance to back off, and this fishing tournament in Cozumel looked just about perfect. It would pry my head out of politics, they said, and force me off in a new direction, out of the valley of death and back toward the land of the living. There was, however, a kink. I had just come back from vacation. It was the first one I'd ever attempted, or at least the first one I'd tried since I was fired from my last regular job on Christmas Day in 1958, when the production manager at Time Magazine ripped up my punch card in a stuttering rage and told me to get the fuck out of the building. Since then, I had been unemployed in the formal sense of that word, and when you've been out of work for 14 years, it's almost impossible to relate to a word like vacation. So I was extremely nervous when circumstances compelled me in the late winter of 72 to fly to Cozumel with my wife Sandy in order to do nothing at all. 3 days later, I ran out of air in a riptide 90 feet down on Palkanar Reef, and I came so close to drowning that they said later I was lucky to get off with a serious case of the bends. The nearest decompression chamber was in Miami, so they chartered a plane and flew me there that same night. I spent the next 19 days in a pressurized sphere somewhere in downtown Miami, and when I finally came out, the bill was $3,000. My wife finally located my attorney in a drug commune on the outskirts of Mazatlan. He flew immediately to Florida and had the courts declare me a pauper, so I was able to leave without legal problems. I went back to Colorado with the idea of resting for at least 6 months. But 3 days after I got home, this assignment came in to cover the fishing tournament. It was a natural, they said, because I was already familiar with the island, and besides, I needed a change from politics. Which was true in a way, but I had my own reasons for wanting to go back to Cozumel. On the evening before my near-fatal scuba dive on Palkanar Reef, I had stashed 50 units of pure MDA in the adobe wall of the shark pool at the local aquarium next to the Hotel Barracuda, and this stash had been much on my mind while I was recovering from the bends in the Miami hospital. So when the Cozumel assignment came through, I drove immediately into town to consult with my old friend and drug crony, Yale Bloor. I explained the circumstances in detail, then asked his advice.
It's clear as a fucking bell. We'll have to go down there at once. You handle a fisherman while I get the drugs.
These were the circumstances that sent me back to Cozumel in late April. Neither the editor nor the high-powered sport fishing crowd we'd be dealing with had any notion of my real reason for making the trip. Bloor knew, but he had a vested interest in maintaining the cover because I was passing him off on the tab as my technical advisor. It made perfect sense, I felt, in order to cover a highly competitive situation. You need plenty of trustworthy help. When I got to Cozumel on Monday afternoon, everybody on the island with any clout in the tourism business was half mad with excitement at the idea of having a genuine, real-life Playboy writer in their midst for a week or 10 days. When I slumped off the plane from Miami, I was greeted like Buffalo Bill on his first trip to Chicago. A whole gaggle of public relations specialists met the plane, and at least three of them were waiting for me. What could they do for me? What did I want? How could they make my life pleasant? Carry my bags? Well, why not? To where? Well, I paused, sensing an unexpected opening that could lead almost anywhere. I think I'm supposed to go to the cabanas, I said. But no, said one of the handlers. You have a press suite at Cozumeleño. I shrugged. Whatever's right, I muttered. Let's roll. I asked the travel agent in Colorado to get me one of those VW Safari Jeeps, the same kind I'd had on my last trip to Cozumel, but the PR crowd at the airport insisted on taking me straight to the hotel. My Jeep, they said, would be delivered within the hour, and in the meantime I was treated like some kind of high-style dignitary. A few people actually addressed me as Mr. Playboy, and the others kept calling me Sir. I was hustled into a waiting car and whisked off along the two-lane blacktop highway, through the palm jungle and out into the general direction of the American Strip, a cluster of beachfront hotels on the northeast end of the island. Despite my lame protests, they took me to the newest, biggest, and most expensive hotel on the island, a huge, stark white concrete bulk that reminded me of the Oakland City Jail. We were met at the desk by the manager, the owner, and several hired heavies who explained that the terrible hammering noise I heard was merely the workmen putting the finishing touches on the third floor of what would eventually be a five-story colossus. We have just 90 rooms now, the manager explained, but by Christmas we will have 300. Jesus God, I muttered. What? Never mind, I said. It's a hell of a thing you're building here. No doubt about that. It's extremely impressive in every way. But the odd fact is that I thought I had reservations down the beach at the cabanas. I flashed a nice shrug and a smile, ignoring the awkward chill that was already settling on us. The manager coughed up a brittle laugh.
The cabanas? No, Señor Playboy. The Cozumeleño is very different from the cabanas.
Yeah, I said, I can see that right off. The Mayan bellboy had already disappeared with my bags.
We saved a junior suite for you, said the manager. I think you'll be satisfied.
His English was very precise. His smile was unnaturally thick, and it was clear from a glance at my high-powered welcoming committee that I was going to be their guest for at least one night. And as soon as they forgot about me, I would flee this huge concrete morgue and sneak off to the comfortable, run-down, palm-shaded piece of the cabanas where I felt much more at home. On the drive out from the airport, the PR man, who was wearing a blue baseball cap and a stylish blue and white t-shirt, both emblazoned with the Lightning Flash Striker logo, had told me that the owner of this new, huge Cozumeleño hotel was a member of the island's ruling family. They own about half of it, he said with a grin. And what they don't own, they control absolutely with their fuel license.
Fuel license?
Yeah, said the PR man. They control every gallon of fuel that's sold here, from the gasoline we're driving on right now in this Jeep, to the gas in every stove in all the hotel restaurants, and even the goddamn jet fuel at the airport. I didn't pay much attention to that talk at the time. It seemed like the same kind of sleazy, power-worshipping bullshit you'd expect to hear from any PR man, anywhere, on any subject, in any situation. My problem was clear from the start. I had come down to Cozumel, officially at least, to cover not just a fishing tournament, but a scene. I'd explained to the editor that big-time sport fishing attracts a certain kind of people, and it was the behavior of these people, not the fishing, that interested me. On my first visit to Cozumel, I discovered the fishing harbor completely by accident one night when Sandy and I were driving around the island, more or less naked, finally twisted on MDA, and the only reason we located the yacht basin was that I took a wrong turn around midnight and tried, without realizing where I was going, to run a roadblock manned by three Mexican soldiers with submachine guns at the entrance to the island's only airport. It was a hard scene to cope with, as I recall, and now that I look back on it, I suspect that moldy white powder we'd eaten was probably some kind of animal tranquilizer instead of true MDA. There is a lot of PCP on the drug market these days. Anybody who wants to put a horse into a coma can buy it pretty easily from, well, why blow that, eh? In any case, we were bent. And after being driven away from the airport by armed guards, I took the next available open road and we would open up. Oh. And we would up in the yacht base. Well, yeah, I guess...
Misprint.
Yeah, it's these Rolling Stone publishers. You know, they need some proofreaders. They're all on PCP anyway. Where were we? Oh, yeah. We're in the yacht basin, where there was a party going on. I could hear it about a half mile off, so I honed in on the music and drove across the highway and about 200 yards down a steep, grassy embankment to get to the dock. Sandy refused to get out of the Jeep, saying that these weren't the kind of people she felt ready to mix with under the circumstances. So I left her huddled under a blanket on the front seat and walked out onto the dock by myself. It was exactly the kind of scene I'd been looking for. About 35 stone-drunk rich honkies from places like Jacksonville and Pompano Beach, reeling around in this midnight Mexican port on their $200,000 power cruisers and cursing the natives for not providing enough teenage whores to go with the mariachi music. It was a scene of total decadence, and I felt right at home in it. I began mixing with the crowd and trying to hire a boat for the next morning, which proved to be very difficult because nobody could understand what I was saying. What's wrong here, I wondered. Is there speed in this drug? Why can't these people understand me? One of the people I was talking to was the owner of a 60-foot Chris craft from Milwaukee. He'd just arrived from Key West that afternoon, he said, and all he seemed to have any real interest in at the moment was the Argentine maid he was grappling with in the cockpit of his boat. She was about 15 years old, had dark blonde hair and red eyes, but it was hard to get a good look at her because Captain Tom, as he introduced himself, was bending her over a styrofoam bait box full of dolphin heads and trying to suck on her collarbone while he talked to me. Finally, I gave up on him and found a local fishing merchant called Fernando Murphy, whose drunkenness was so crude and extreme that we were able to communicate perfectly, even though he spoke little English. "No fishing at night," he said. "Come to my shop downtown by the plaza tomorrow and I rent you a nice boat." "Wonderful," I said. "How much?" He laughed and fell against a pasty blonde woman from New Orleans who was too drunk to talk. "For you," he said, $140 a day, and I guarantee fish." "Why not?" I said. "I'll be there at dawn." Had the boat ready. "Chingado!" he screamed. He dropped his drink on the dock and began grappling with his own shoulder blades. I was taken aback at his outburst, not understanding for a moment, until I saw that a laughing 300-pound man wearing Levi's and a red baseball hat in the cockpit of a nearby boat, called Black Snapper, had hooked the back of his Murphy shirt with a 30-pound marlin rod and was trying to reel him in. Murphy staggered backwards, screaming, "Chigado!" once again as he fell backwards. Wait a minute, let me read that again. Murphy staggered backwards, screaming, "Chigado!" once again as he fell sideways on the dock and ripped his shirt open. Well, I thought, no point trying to do business with this crowd tonight. And in fact, I never fished on that trip. But the general low tone of that party had stayed with me, a living caricature of white trash run amok on foreign shores. An appalling kind of story, but not without a certain human interest quotient. On the first day of the tournament, I spent 8 hours at sea aboard the eventual winner, a 54 striker called Sundancer, owned by a wealthy middle-aged industrialist named Frank Oliver from Palatka, Florida. Oliver ran a fleet of barges on the inland waterway out of Jacksonville, he said, and Sundancer was the only boat in the Cozumel Harbor flying a Confederate flag. He had about 325,000 in it, he said, including a network of built-in vacuum cleaner wall plugs for the deep pile carpets. And although he said he spent maybe 5 weeks out of the year on the boat, he was a very serious angler and he meant to win this tournament. To this end, he had hired one of the world's top fishing captains, a speedy little cracker named Cliff North, and turned Sundancer over to him on a year-round basis. North is a living legend in the sport fishing world, and the idea that Oliver would hire him as his personal captain was not entirely acceptable to the other anglers. One of them explained that it was like some rich weekend duffer hiring Arnold Palmer to shoot the final round of the Greater Cleveland Elks golf tourney for him. North lives on the boat with his wife and his two young mates who do all the menial work, and during the 10 months of the year when Oliver's not around, he charters Sundancer out to anyone who can pay the rate. All Cliff has to do in return for this sinecure is make sure Oliver wins the 3 or 4 fishing tournaments he finds time to enter each year. Thanks to North and his expert boat handling, Frank Oliver is now listed in the sport fishing record books as one of the world's top anglers. Whether or not Oliver would win any tournaments without North and Sundancer is a subject of widespread disagreement and occasional rude opinion among sport fishing pros. Not even the most egotistical anglers will deny that a good boat and a hot rod captain to handle it are crucial factors in ocean fishing. But there is a definite division of opinion between anglers, who are mainly rich amateurs, and pros, the boat captain and the crews, about the relative value of skills. Most of the pros I talked to in Cozumel were reluctant at first to speak on this subject, at least for the record. But after the third or fourth drink, they would invariably come around to suggesting that anglers were more of a hazard than a help. And as a general rule of thumb, you could catch more fish just by jamming the rod into a holder on the rear end of the boat and letting the fish do the work. After 2 or 3 days on the boats, the most generous consensus I could get from the pros was that even the best angler is worth about a 10% advantage in a tournament, and that most are seen as handicaps. Jesus God Almighty, said a veteran captain from Fort Lauderdale one night in a local hotel bar. You wouldn't believe the things I've seen these fools do. He laughed, but the sound was nervous and his body seemed to shudder as the memories came back on him. One of the people I work for, he said, has a wife who's just flat out crazy. He shook his head wearily. I don't want you to get me wrong now. I love her dearly, as a person. But when it comes to fishing, God damn it, I'd like to chop her up and toss her out for the sharks. He took a long hit on his rum and coke. Yeah, I hate to say it, but that's all she's good for. Shark bait and nothing else. Jesus, the other day she almost killed herself. We hooked a big sailfish, and when that happens, you have to move pretty fast, you know. But all of a sudden, I heard her screaming like crazy. When I looked down from the bridge, she had her hair all tangled up in the reel. He laughed. God damn, can you believe that? She almost got scalped. I had to jump down about 15 feet on a wet deck in a bad sea. We were wallowing all around and cut the whole line loose with my knife. She came within about 10 seconds of having all her hair pulled out. Few anglers, and especially winners like Frank Oliver, agree with the pros' 90-10 split. It's basically a teamwork situation, says Oliver, like a chain with no weak links. The angler, the captain, the mates, the boat, they're all critical. They work like gears with each other. Yeah, well, maybe so. Oliver won the tournament with 28 sailfish in the 3 days that counted. But he was fishing alone on Sundancer, a boat so lavishly outfitted it could have passed for the nautical den in Nelson Rockefeller's. I want to read that again. A boat so lavishly outfitted it could have passed for the nautical den in Nelson Rockefeller's Fifth Avenue apartment, and with the Arnold Palmer of sport fishing up on the bridge. Most of his competition were fishing in twos and threes on charter boats they were assigned to at random, with wild-tempered, contemptuous captains they'd never even met before yesterday morning. Fishing against Cliff North is bad enough, said Jerry Hagen, captain of a stripped-down hulk of a boat called Lucky Striker. But when you have to go against North and only one angler, with everything set up exactly the way he wants it, that's just about impossible. which is neither here nor there in the rules of big-time sport fishing. If B.B. Rebozo decided to borrow $500,000 from the Pentagon at no interest and enter the Cozumel tournament with the best boat he could buy and a crew of specially trained U.S. Marines, he would compete on the same basis with me if I entered the thing with a 110-year-old Colorado River J boat and a crew of drug-crazed politicos from the Meat Possum Athletic Club. According to the rules, we'd be equal. And while BB could fish alone on his boat, the tournament directors could assign me a nightmarish trio of anglers like Sam Brown, John Mitchell, and Baby Huey. Could we win? Never in hell. But nobody connected with that tournament would ever forget the experience, which is almost what happened anyway, for different reasons. By the third day of the tournament, or maybe it was the fourth, I had lost all control of my coverage. At one point, when Bluer ran amok and disappeared for 30 hours, I was forced to jerk a dope addict out of the island's only nightclub and press him into service as a special observer for Playboy. He spent the final day of the tournament aboard Sundancer, snorting coke in the head and jabbering wildly at North, while poor Oliver struggled desperately to maintain his one-fish lead over Hagen's manic crew on Lucky Striker. Thursday night was definitely the turning point. Whatever rapport Bloor and I had developed with the Striker people was wearing very thin after 3 days of increasingly strange behavior and the antisocial attitude we apparently manifested at the big Striker cocktail party at the Punta Morena beach bar was clearly unacceptable. Almost everybody there was staggering drunk by nightfall, and the ugliness threshold was low. Here were all these heavy anglers, prosperous Florida businessmen for the most part, snarling and snapping at one another like East Harlem street fighters on the eve of a long-awaited rumble. You pot-bellied asshole, you couldn't catch a fish in a goddamn barrel. Watch your stupid lip, fella. That's my wife you just stepped on. Whose wife, fat face? Keep your fucking hands to yourself. Where's the goddamn waiter? Boy! Over here! Give me another drink, will ya? Let me just put it to you this way, my friend. How about a goddamn fish off? Just you and me for $1,000, huh? Yeah, how about it? Yes, people were lurching around the sand with plates full of cold macaroni and shrimp sauce. Every now and then somebody would jerk one of the giant turtles out of the tank on the patio and thrust it in the face of some bleary-eyed bystander, laughing wildly and struggling to hang on to the thing, big green flippers clawing frantically at the air and lashing a spray of stale turtle water on everybody within a radius of 10 feet. Here, I want you to meet my friend. She'll do a real job on your pecker. How horny are ya?
You're listening to Community Radio for the Northwest, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato with Woody Creek. And this evening, we are giving a gonzo presentation of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson's The Great Shark Hunt.
You know, this is from the Gonzo Papers, Volume 1, Strange Tales from a Strange Time. Also known as The Great Shark Hunt. Some vintage Hunter Thompson in it. And as an editor's note, I want to say Mr. Director Fortunato over there has advised me to tell you that this is an abridged version. We've had an argument and we've settled it now. We're skipping over a lot of good stuff.
That'll teach you to pull a knife on me.
See, well, I have to trust this director. Besides, he took my knife.
And now, part two, The Great Shark Hunt by Hunter S. Thompson.
Looking back on all that, my only feeling for deep sea fishing is one of absolute and visceral aversion. Hemingway had the right idea when he decided that a .45 caliber submachine gun was the proper tool for shark fishing, but he was wrong about his targets. Why shoot innocent fish when the guilty walk free along the docks, renting boats for $140 a day to drunken dupes who call themselves sport fishermen? Our departure from the island was not placid. The rough skeleton of the plan, as I conceived it with a head full of MDA the night before, was to wait until about an hour before the first early morning flight to Merida on Aeromexico, then jump both our hotel bills by checking out in a raving frenzy at dawn at the end of the night clerk's shift and signing Playboy Striker Aluminum Yachts on both bills. I felt this bogus dual imprimatur would be heavy enough to confuse both desk clerks just long enough for us to reach the airport and make our escape. There was no question in my mind once the plane was finally airborne out of Cozumel, about what to do with the drugs. I had eaten three of the remaining five caps of MDA during the night, and Bloor had given our hash and all but six of his purple pills to the Black Coral Wizard as a bonus for his all-night efforts. As we zoomed over the Yucatan Channel at 8,000 feet, we took stock of what we had left. Two hits of MDA, six tabs of acid, about a gram and a half of raw cocaine, four reds, and a random handful of speed. That, plus $44, and a desperate hope that Sandy had made and paid for our reservations beyond Monterrey, Mexico, was all we had between Cozumel and our refuge destination at Sam Brown's house in Denver. We were airborne out of Cozumel at 8:13 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time, and if everything went right, we would arrive at Denver Stapleton International Airport before 7. We'd been airborne for about 8 minutes when I looked over at Bloor and told him what I'd been thinking. "We don't have enough drugs here to risk carrying them through customs," I said. He nodded thoughtfully.
"Well, we're pretty well fixed for poor boys."
"Yeah, but I have my professional reputation to uphold. And there's only two things I've never done with drugs: sell them or take them through customs, especially when we can replace everything we're holding for about $99 just as soon as we get off the plane." He hunkered down in his seat, saying nothing. Then he stared across at me.
"What are you saying? That we should just throw all this shit away?"
I thought for a moment. "No, I think we should eat it."
"What?"
"Yeah, why not? They can't bust you for what's already dissolved in your belly, no matter how weird you're acting."
"Jesus Christ, we're going to go stark raving nuts if we eat all this shit."
I shrugged. "Keep in mind where we'll be when we hit customs. San Antonio, Texas. Are you ready to get busted in Texas?" He stared down at his fingernails. "Remember Tim Leary? 10 years for 3 ounces of grass in his daughter's panties."
"Jesus, Texas. I'd forgotten about that."
"Not me. When Sandy went through customs in San Antonio about 3 weeks ago, they tore everything she was carrying apart. It took about 3 hours to put it back together." I could see him thinking.
"Well, what if we eat this stuff and go crazy? They'll nail us."
"Nothing. We'll drink heavily. If we're seized, the stewardesses will just testify we were drunk."
"Yeah, just a couple of good old boys OD'd on booze. Nasty drunks staggering back into the country after a shameful vacation in Mexico. Totally fucked up."
"Right. They can strip us down to the skin. It's no crime to enter the country helplessly drunk."
"You're right. What do we start with? We shouldn't eat it all at once. That's too heavy."
I nodded, reaching into my pocket for the MDA and offering him one as I tossed the other into my mouth. "Let's eat some of the acid now, too. That way we'll be adjusted to it by the time we have to eat the rest. And we can save the coke for emergencies."
"Along with the speed, how much do you have left?"
10 hits. Pure white amphetamine powder. It'll straighten us out. Things get tense.
"Well, you should save that for the end. We can use this coke if we start getting messy."
I swallowed the purple pill, ignoring the Mexican stewardess with her tray of sangria.
"I'll have two."
"Same here."
"Pay no attention. We're just tourists down here making fools of ourselves."
A moment later, we hit down on the runway at Merida. But it was a quick and painless stop. By 9 a.m., we were cruising over central Mexico at 20,000 feet, headed for Monterrey. The plane was half empty, and we could have moved around if we'd wanted to. But I glanced over at Bloor, trying to use him as a mirror for my own condition, and decided that wandering around the aisles would not be wise. Making yourself noticeable is one thing, but causing innocent passengers to shrink off with feelings of shock and repugnance is a different game entirely. One of the few things that can't be controlled about acid is the glitter it puts in the eyes. No amount of booze will cause the same kind of laughing, that fine predatory glow that comes with the first rush of acid up the spine. But Bloor felt like moving.
"Now is the goddamn head."
"Never mind. We're almost to Monterrey. Don't attract attention. We have to check through immigration there."
"Immigration?"
"It's nothing serious. Just turn in our tourist cards, see about the tickets to Denver. But we'll have to act straight."
"Why?"
I gave it some thought. Why indeed? We were clean. We're almost clean anyway. About an hour out of Merida, we'd eaten another round of acid, which left us with two more of those, plus four reds and the coke and the speed. The luck of the split had left me with the speed and the acid. Bloor had the coke and the reds. And by the time the Abroche su Cinturon, fasten seatbelts, sign flashed on above Monterey, we'd agreed more or less that anything we hadn't eaten by the time we got to Texas would have to be flushed down the stainless steel john in the plane's lavatory. It had taken about 45 tortured minutes to reach this agreement, because by that time neither one of us could speak clearly. I tried to whisper through gritted teeth, but each time I succeeded in uttering a coherent sentence, my voice seemed to echo around the cabin like I was mumbling into a bullhorn. At one point, I leaned over as close as possible to Bloor's ear and hissed, "Reds, how many?" But the sound of my own voice was such a shock that I recoiled in horror and tried to pretend I'd said nothing. Was the stewardess staring? I couldn't be sure. Bloor had seemed not to notice, but suddenly, he was thrashing around in his seat, clawing frantically underneath himself with both hands.
"What the fuck?"
"Quiet! What's wrong with you?" He was jerking at his seatbelt, still shouting. The stewardess ran down the aisle and unbuckled it for him. There was fear in her face as she backed off and watched him spring out of his seat.
"God damn you, clumsy bastard!"
I stared straight ahead. "Jesus," I thought, "he's blowing it. He can't handle the acid. I should have abandoned this crazy bastard in Cozumel." I felt my teeth grinding as I tried to ignore his noise. Then I glanced across and saw him groping between the seats and coming up with a smoldering cigarette butt.
"Look at this!"
He was holding the butt in one hand and fondling the back of his thigh with the other.
"Burned a big hole in my pants. He just spit this dirty thing right down in my seat."
"What?" I said, feeling in front of my mouth for the cigarette in my filter. But the filter was empty, and I suddenly understood. The fog in my brain suddenly cleared, and I heard myself laughing. "I warned you about these goddamn bonanzas. They'll never stick in the filter." The stewardess was pushing him back down into his seat. "Fasten belts," she kept saying. "Fasten belts." I grabbed his arm and jerked downward, pulling him off balance and causing him to fall heavily onto the back of the seat. It gave way and collapsed on the legs of whoever was sitting behind us. The stewardess jerked it quickly back to the upright position, then reached down to fasten Bloor's seatbelt. I saw his left arm snake out and settle affectionately around her shoulders. "Good God," I thought, "this is it." I could see the headlines in tomorrow's news. Drug fracas on airliner near Monterey. Gringos jailed on arson assault charges. But the stewardess only smiled and backed off a few steps, dismissing Bloor's crude advance with a slap at his arm and an icy professional smile. I tried to return it, but my face was not working properly. Her eyes narrowed. She was clearly more insulted by the demented grin I was trying now to fix on her than she was by Bloor's attempt to push her head down into his lap. He smiled happily as she stalked away.
"That'll teach you. You're a goddamn nightmare to travel with."
The acid was leveling out now. I could tell by the tone of his voice that he was into the manic stage. No more of that jerky, paranoid whispering. He was feeling confident now. His face had settled into that glaze of brittle serenity you invariably see on the face of a veteran acid eater who knows that the first rush is past and now he can settle down for about 6 hours of real fun. I was not quite there myself, but I knew it was coming. And we still had about 7 more hours and 2 plane changes between now and Denver. I knew the immigration scene at Monterey was only a formality. Just stand in line for a while with all the other gringos and not get hysterical when the cop at the gate asks for your tourist card. We could ease through that one, I felt, on the strength of long experience. Anybody who's still on the street after 7 or 8 years of public acid eating has learned to trust his adrenaline gland for getting through routine confrontations with officialdom, traffic citations, bridge tolls, airline ticket counters. And we had one of these coming up, getting our baggage off this plane and not losing it in the airport and on the legs of whoever was sitting behind us. The stewardess jerked it quickly back to the upright position, then reached down to fasten Bloor's seatbelt. I saw his left arm snake out and settle affectionately around her shoulders. Good God, I thought, this is it. I could see the headlines in tomorrow's news. Drug fracas on airliner near Monterey. Gringos jailed on arson assault charges. But the stewardess only smiled and backed off a few steps, dismissing Bloor's crude advance with a slap at his arm and an icy professional smile. I tried to return it, but my face was not working properly. Her eyes narrowed. She was clearly more insulted by the demented grin I was trying now to fix on her than she was by Bloor's attempt to push her head down into his lap. He smiled happily as she stalked away.
"That'll teach you. You're a goddamn nightmare to travel with."
The acid was leveling out now. I could tell by the tone of his voice that he was into the manic stage. No more of that jerky, paranoid whispering. He was feeling confident now. His face had settled into that glaze of brittle serenity you invariably see on the face of a veteran acid eater who knows that the first rush is past and now he can settle down for about 6 hours of real fun. I was not quite there myself, but I knew it was coming. And we still had about 7 more hours and 2 plane changes between now and Denver. I knew the immigration scene at Monterey was only a formality. Just stand in line for a while with all the other gringos and not get hysterical when the cop at the gate asks for your tourist card. We could ease through that one, I felt, on the strength of long experience. Anybody who's still on the street after 7 or 8 years of public acid eating has learned to trust his adrenaline gland for getting through routine confrontations with officialdom, traffic citations, bridge tolls, airline ticket counters. And we had one of these coming up, getting our baggage off this plane and not losing it in the airport until we found out which flight would take us to San Antonio and Denver. Bloor was traveling light with only 2 bags, but I had my normal heavy load. 2 huge leather suitcases, a canvas sea bag, and tape recorder with 2 portable speakers. If we were going to lose anything, I wanted to lose it north of the border. Monterey Airport is a cool, bright little building, so immaculately clean and efficient that we were almost immediately lulled into a condition of grinning euphoria. Everything seemed to be working perfectly. No lost baggage, no sudden outbursts of wild jabbering at the immigration desk, no cause for panic or fits of despair at the ticket counter. Our first class reservations had already been made and confirmed all the way to Denver. Bloor had been reluctant to blow $32 extra, quote, just to sit up front with the businessmen, unquote, but I felt it was necessary. There's a lot more latitude for weird behavior in first class, I told him. The stewardesses back in the tourist section don't have as much experience, so they're more likely to freak out if they think they have a dangerous nut on their hands.
Do I look like a dangerous nut?
I shrugged. It was hard to focus on his face. We were standing in a corridor outside the souvenir shop. You look like a serious dope addict, I said finally. Your hair is all wild, your eyes are glittering, your nose is all red, and... I suddenly noticed white powder on the top edge of his mustache. Swine, you've been into the coke!
Why not? Just a little pick-me-up?
Yeah. Just wait till you start explaining yourself to the customs agent in San Antonio with white powder drooling out of your nose. Have you ever seen those big bullet-nose flashlights they use for rectal searches? We're attracting a crowd. Let's get to the bar where it's safe. Moments later, we were sitting at a table overlooking the runway, sipping margaritas and watching the ground crew load the 727 that would take us to San Antonio. My plan was to stay hunkered down in the bar until the last moment, then dash for the plane. Our luck had been excellent so far, but that scene in the lobby had triggered a wave of paranoia in my head. I felt very conspicuous. Bloor's mannerisms were becoming more and more psychotic. He took one sip of his drink, then whacked it down onto the table and stared at me.
What is this?
It's a double margarita, I said, glancing over at the waitress to see if she now had her eye on us. She did, and Bloor waved at her. What do you want?
I have a glaucoma.
The waitress was honest before I could argue. Glaucoma is an extremely complicated mix of about 9 unlikely ingredients that Bloor had learned from some randy old woman he met on the porch of the Bal High. She'd taught the bartender there how to make it. Very precise measurements of gin, tequila, Kahlua, crushed ice, fruit juices, lime rinds, spices, all mixed to perfection in a tall frosted glass. It is not the kind of drink you want to order in an airport bar with a head full of acid and a noticeable speech impediment, especially when you can't speak the local language and you just spilled the first drink you ordered all over the table. But Bloor persisted. When the waitress abandoned all hope, he walked over to speak with the bartender. I slumped in my chair, keeping an eye on the plane and hoping it was almost ready to go. But they hadn't even loaded the baggage yet. Departure time was still 20 minutes away. Plenty of time for some minor incident to mushroom. Plenty of time for some minor incident to mushroom into serious trouble. I watched Bloor talking to the bartender, pointing to various bottles behind the bar and occasionally using his fingers to indicate measurements. The bartender was nodding his head patiently. Finally, Bloor came back to the table.
He's making it. I'll be back in a minute. I have business.
I ignored him. My mind was drifting again. 2 days and nights without sleep, plus a steady diet of mind-altering drugs and double margaritas were beginning. I ordered another drink and stared out at the hot brown hills beyond the runway. The bar was comfortably air-conditioned, but I could feel the warm sun through the window. Why worry, I thought. We've survived the worst. All we have to do now is not miss that plane out there. Once we're across the border, the worst that can happen is a nightmarish fuck-around at customs in San Antonio. Maybe even a night in jail, but what the hell? A few misdemeanor charges, public drunkenness, disturbing the peace, resisting arrest. But nothing serious, no felony. All the evidence for that would be eaten by the time we landed in Texas. My only real worry now was the chance that there might be already grand larceny charges filed against us in Cozumel. We had, after all, jumped two hotel bills totaling about 15,000 pesos. In addition to leaving that half-destroyed Avis Jeep in the airport parking lot, another 15,000 pesos. And we had spent the past 4 or 5 days in the constant company of a flagrant big-volume drug runner whose every movement and contact, for all we know, might have been watched or even photographed by Interpol agents. As I finished my drink and called for another, a paranoid shudder jerked me out of my slump in the chair. I sat up and looked around. Where was that bastard Bloor? How long had he been gone? I glanced out at the plane and saw the fuel truck still parked under the wing, but they were loading the baggage now. Only 10 more minutes. I relaxed again, shoving a handful of pesos at the waitress to pay for our drinks, trying to smile at her, when suddenly the whole airport seemed to echo with the sound of my name being shouted over 1,000 loudspeakers. Then I heard Bloor's name, a harsh, heavily accented voice, bellowing along the corridors like the scream of a banshee.
Passengers Hunter Thompson and Yale Bloor report immediately to the immigration desk.
I was too stunned to move. Mother of 12 bastards. Did I actually hear that? I was gripping both arms of my chair and tried to concentrate. Was I hallucinating again? There was no way to be sure. Then I heard the voice again, booming all over the airport.
Will passengers Hunter Thompson and Yale Bloor report immediately to the immigration desk?
No, I thought. This is impossible. It had to be paranoid dementia. My fear of being nailed at the last moment had become so intense I was just hearing voices. The sun through the window had caused the acid to boil in my brain. A huge bubble of drugs had burst a weak vein in my frontal lobes. Then I saw Bloor rushing into the bar. His eyes were wild. His hands were flapping crazily.
Did you hear that?
I stared at him. Well, I thought, we're fucked. He heard it too. Or even if he hadn't, even if we're both hallucinating, it means we've OD'd. Totally out of control for the next 6 hours, crazed with fear and confusion, feeling our bodies disappear and our heads swell up like balloons, unable to even recognize each other.
Wake up! God damn it! We have to make a run for the plane!
I shrugged. It's no use. They'll grab us at the gate.
Are you sure those were our names they called, or are you positive?
He was frantically trying to zip up his kit bag. I nodded, still not moving. Somewhere in the middle of my half-numb brain, the truth was beginning to stir. I was not hallucinating. This nightmare was real, and I suddenly remembered the Stryker PR man's talk about all that. I suddenly remembered the Stryker PR man's talk about that all-powerful
Jaffa
in Cozumel, who had the fuel license. Of course, a man with that kind of leverage would have connections all over Mexico. Police, airlines, immigration. It was madness to think we could cross him and get away with it. No doubt he controlled the Avis franchise, too. And he'd gone into action the minute his henchmen found that crippled Jeep in the airport parking lot with its windshield shattered and an 11-day bill unpaid. The phone lines had been humming 20,000 feet beneath us all the way to Monterey. And now, with less than 10 minutes to spare, they had ambushed us. I stood up and slung the sea bag over my shoulder, just as the waitress brought Bloor's glaucoma. He looked at her, then lifted it off the tray and drank the whole thing in one gulp.
Gracias, gracias.
He handed her a 50 peso note.
Nada. Keep the goddamn change. Back door. Exito.
He pointed towards the kitchen. He nodded at the plane about 50 feet below us on the runway. I could see a few passengers beginning to board.
Big hurry. This is a goddamn outrage. All this wax on these floors. I almost got killed.
Little cop grinned again. Was there something sadistic in his smile? I couldn't be sure, but it didn't matter now. They had us on the gaff. I flashed on all the people I knew who'd been busted in Mexico. Dopers who'd pushed their luck too far, gotten careless. No doubt we would find friends in prison. I could almost hear them hooting their cheerful greetings as we were led into the yard and turned loose. This scene passed through my head in milliseconds. Bloor's wild yells were still floating in the air as the cop began pushing me out the door toward the plane. Hurry, hurry, he was saying, and behind me I heard his assistant prodding Bloor. We were afraid you would miss the plane, he was saying. We called you on the PA system. He was grinning broadly now. You almost missed the plane. We were almost to San Antonio before I got a grip on myself. The adrenaline was still pumping violently through my head. The acid and booze and fatigue had been totally neutralized by that scene at the gate. My nerves were so jangled as the plane took off that I had to beg the stewardess for two scotch and waters, which I used to down two of our four reds. Bloor ate the other two with the help of two Bloody Marys. His hands were trembling badly. His eyes were filled with blood. But as he came back to life, he began cursing.
Those bastards on the PA system.
Who had caused him to panic and get rid of all the coke.
Jesus. You can imagine what a horror that was. I was standing there at the urinal with my joint in one hand and a coke spoon in the other, jamming the stuff up my nose and trying to piss at the same time, when all of a fucking sudden it just exploded all around me. They have a speaker up there in the corner of that bathroom, and the whole place is tile. Shit, I almost went crazy. It was like somebody had snuck up behind me and dropped a cherry bomb down the back of my shirt. All I could think of was getting rid of the coke. I threw it into one of the urinals and ran like a bastard for the bar. Hell, I didn't even zip up my pants. I was running down the hall with my joint hanging out.
I smiled, remembering the sense of almost apocalyptic despair that seized me when I heard the first announcement. That's odd, I said. It never even occurred to me to get rid of the drugs. I was just thinking about all those hotel bills and the goddamn Jeep. If they nailed us for that stuff, a few pills wouldn't make much difference. He seemed to brood for a while. Then he spoke, staring fixedly at the seat in front of him.
Well, I don't know about you, but I don't think I could stand another shock like that one. I had about 90 seconds of pure terror. Felt my whole life had ended. Jesus, standing at that urinal with a coke spoon up my nose and suddenly hearing my name on the speaker. Now I know how Liddy must have felt when he saw those cops running into the Watergate. Seeing his whole life fall apart from a hot rod in the White House to a 20-year jailbird in 60 seconds.
Fuck Liddy. It couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Liddy was the bastard who ran Operation Intercept. Remember that? What do you think would have happened if Gordon Liddy had been standing at the gate when we came crashing through?
Yeah.
He smiled, sipping his drink.
Yeah.
We'd be sitting in a Mexican jail right now. Just one of those pills, I held up a purple acid tab, would have been enough to drive Liddy into a hate frenzy. He'd have had us locked up on suspicion of everything from hijacking to dope smuggling. He looked at the pill I was holding, then reached for it.
Well, let's finish these off. I can't stand this nervousness.
You're right, I said, reaching into my pocket for the other one. We're almost to San Antonio. I tossed the pill down my throat and called the stewardess for another drink.
Is that it? Are we clean?
Yep, except for the speed.
Oh, get rid of it. We're almost there.
Don't worry. This acid will take hold just about the time we land. We should order more drinks. I unbuckled my seatbelt and walked up the aisle to the lavatory, fully intending to flush the speed down the toilet. But when I got inside, with the door locked behind me, I stared down at the little buggers resting so peacefully there in my palm. 10 caps of pure white amphetamine powder, and I thought, no, we might need these in case of another emergency. I remembered the dangerous lethargy that had gripped me in Monterey. Then I looked down at my white canvas basketball shoes and noticed how snugly the tongues fit under the laces. Plenty of pressure down there, I thought, and plenty of room for 10 pills. So I put all the speed in my shoes and went back to the seat. No point mentioning it to Bloor, I thought. He's clean and therefore totally innocent. It would only inhibit his capacity for righteous anger, I felt, if I told him about the speed I was still carrying. Until we were safely through customs and reeling blindly around the San Antonio airport, then he would thank me for it. San Antonio was a cakewalk. No trouble at all, despite the fact that we virtually fell off the plane, badly twisted again. And by the time we got our bags onto the conveyor belt leading up to the tall black customs agent, we were both laughing like fools at the trail of orange amphetamine pills strung out behind us on the floor of the tin-roofed customs shed. I was arguing with the agent about how much import tax I would have to pay on the two bottles of Prima tequila I was carrying, when I noticed Bloor had almost doubled over with laughter right beside me. He had just paid a tax of $5.88 on his own tequila, and now he was cracking up while the agent fussed over my tax. The hell's wrong with you? I snapped, glancing back at him. Then I noticed he was looking down at my feet, fighting so hard to control his laughter that he was having trouble keeping his balance. I looked down, and there, about 6 inches from my right shoe, was a bright orange spancule. Another one was sitting on the black rubber floor mat about 2 feet behind me, and 2 feet farther back was another. They looked about as big as footballs. insane, I thought. I've left a trail of speed all the way from the plane to this beetle-browed customs agent who was now handing me the official receipt for my liquor tax. I accepted it with a smile that was already disintegrating into hysteria as I took it out of his hand. He was staring grimly at Bloor, who was out of control now, still laughing at the floor. The customs man couldn't see what Yale was laughing at because of the conveyor belt between us, but I could. It was another of those goddamn orange balls resting on the white canvas toe of my shoe. I reached down as casually as I could and put the thing in my pocket. The customs man watched us with a look of total disgust on his face, and we hauled our bags through the swinging wooden doors and into the lobby of the San Antonio airport.
Can you believe that? Never even looked inside these goddamn things. For all he knows, we just came across the border with 200 pounds of pure skag.
I stopped laughing. It was true. My big suitcase, the elephant skin Abercrombie and Fitch job with the brass corners, was still securely locked. Not one of our bags had been opened for even the laziest inspection. We had listed the 5 quarts of tequila on our declaration forms, and that was all that seemed to interest him.
Jesus Christ. If only we had known.
I smiled, but I was still feeling nervous about it. There was something almost eerie about two laughing, staggering dopers checking through one of the heaviest drug checkpoints on the customs map without even opening their bags. It was almost insulting. The more I thought about it, the angrier I felt. Because that cold-eyed dude had been absolutely right. He had sized us up perfectly with one glance. I could almost hear him thinking, "God damn, look at these two slobbering honkies. Anybody this fucked up can't be serious." Which was true. The only thing we slipped past him was a single cap of speed, and even that was an accident. So in truth, he had saved himself a lot of unnecessary work by ignoring our baggage. I would have preferred not to understand this embarrassment so keenly, because it plunged me into a fit of depression, despite the acid, or maybe because of it. The rest of that trip was a nightmare of paranoid blunders and the kind of small humiliations that haunt you for many weeks afterwards. About halfway between San Antonio and Denver, Bloor reached out into the aisle and grabbed the stewardess by the leg, causing her to drop a tray of 21 wine glasses, which crashed in a heap at her feet and ignited rumblings of bad discontent from the other first-class passengers who had ordered wine with their lunch. "You stinking dope addict bastard," I muttered, trying to ignore him in the burst of ugliness that was surrounding us. He grinned stupidly, ignoring the howls of the stewardess, and fixed me with a dazed, uncomprehending stare that confirmed forever my convictions that nobody with even latent inclinations to use drugs should ever try to smuggle them. We were virtually shoveled off the plane in Denver, laughing and staggering in such a rotten condition that we were barely able to claim our luggage. Months later, I received a letter from a friend in Cozumel asking if I were still interested in buying an interest in some beach acres on the Caribbean shores. It arrived just as I was preparing to leave for Washington to cover the impeachment of Richard Nixon, the final act in a drama that began for me almost exactly a year earlier when I had bought a news from a newsboy hustling the porch of the Bal High in Cozumel and read John Dean's original outcry about refusing to be the scapegoat. Well, a lot of madness has flowed under our various bridges since then. And we have all presumably learned a lot of things. John Dean is in prison. Richard Nixon has quit and been pardoned by his hand-picked successor. And my feeling for national politics is about the same as my feeling for deep-sea fishing, buying land in Cozumel, or anything else where the losers end up thrashing around in the water on a barbed hook. Hunter S. Thompson, December 1974.
You've been listening to The Great Shark Hunt, presented on Gremlin Time with our special guest, Woody Creek.
I'm going to go lay down.
Okay, he's going to go lay down. We've had enough here. I'd like to thank you for listening this evening. We'll be back again next month as we present The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. Join us then next time here on Gremlin Time. Oh, we made that. I forget how many years ago we made that. Maybe about 5 years ago or so. Still holds up. There's like a bad spot in there. I got to correct it there. But that was Hunter S. Thompson. We did that about this, a couple months after he passed away. So we'll be back. I don't know what we'll have on Gremlin Time next month. Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. This has been Fortunato. Thanks for listening to Gremlin Time. And this is Community Radio, KBOO Portland. I come up hard, but that's okay, 'cause trouble man, don't get in my way. Hey, hey, I know some places and I see some faces. I got good connections, they dig my directions. When people say that's okay, they don't bother me. I'm ready to make it, don't care what the weather, don't care about no trouble, got myself together. I feel the kind of protection that's all around.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha Cha Club.
Let's put on the show.
Ole, ole, it's show time.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd be the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
The boys in the back are called macaws.
Because of their claws?
No, because they're macaws. And our fine feathered friend is a jolly toucan. And toucan sounds better than one toucan can.
In the tiki 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 room. In the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room. All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you.